We'll call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Friday, January 30th. Welcome back. We did not quite finish the DHS items. I think we have two or three items left to go, two in health care and one in continuing care. I guess I'll go with the department's preference. Which would you, either Chuck Johnson or Nathan Morocco? And the continuing care one is not on members' agenda. Apologies about that. It was on a slide we were intending to cover as Commissioner Jessen had to leave, and we skipped one of the items. So we can, if you'll orient us to which one you'd like to cover, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Human Services. So I have two components left over from yesterday. I'll direct you to page 139. Mr. Chair, this is a proposal related to MA lien processing. I want to make clear that this doesn't change circumstances under which we would use a lien, but it does make the lien process itself more effective. So both state and federal law require MA recipients to contribute to the cost of their care when they're able. And so there are some circumstances where a lien is put onto a property as a means of just capturing that should something occur with that property down the road, that the program is interested in gaining access to some of those assets. So really what we're doing here is removing the administrative complexity to the lien process. Oftentimes it's ensuring that we receive notification. So in cases of foreclosure or in a sale situations, we're simply being notified, or that our lien is staying on that property or on that title, so that transfer of titling or through the foreclosure process, that lien isn't somehow stripped away. So it's mostly a proposal related to notification and just ensuring that that we have an understanding of what's going on with that property, and also that the property holder or perhaps the subsequent holders understand that there is a lien against that property.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll direct you then to page 141. This is really addressing a sustainable Minnesota Care program. I'm sure as you're aware, Minnesota Care provides coverage for about 85,000 Minnesotans. Unlike medical assistance, Minnesota Care does require the enrollees to pay some premium and some cost sharing. And this is really addressing the health care access fund. So currently there's a deficit of $65.5 million in fiscal year 16 and 17 for the Healthcare Access Fund. What this proposal does is solve that $65 million problem really through two ways. The first would be some modest premium adjustments, and the second would be some adjustments on the plan design side. On the premium, we would be targeting in the range of 150 to 200% of the federal poverty guideline, and there would be a graduated increase between those percentages. So some increase at the 150 level with a slightly higher increase as you get closer to 200. And that would account for about one-third of the deficit of roughly $20 million. The other $40 million would then come through plan design. What we have targeted really at this point is an actuarial value in terms of change. So currently Minnesota Care sits at about 98% actuarial value. That means that the plan itself covers about 98% of the cost, with the client picking up about 2%. We would be moving that to a 94% actuarial value, and that move generates about $40.5 million. So in combination, the two would cover the healthcare access fund, and we're currently looking at how the kinds of changes that we would be making. But again, in aggregate or in total, they would be worth $40 million, and so at this point, we're targeting just an actuarial value.
Well, just to make you aware, I believe you are, we will be watching carefully what the details on this one are. I mean, I think that, to frame it as a sustainability issue, I take a little bit of challenge with as well. I mean, I think that while we have some challenges, we do need to make sure that the health care access fund comes in balance. This is not a higher expenditure than we've experienced for the 20 years that we've had a commitment to low-income, hardworking Minnesotans. And so I think we, as policymakers, have made it a commitment to sustain our dedication to ensuring the health and financial well-being in this essentially ladder out of poverty for individuals that would struggle with what the private marketplace has to offer. I think that the low-premium, high-deductible plans that are available in the private market are a fairly unhealthy place for our lowest-income consumers. And so we're going to need to be watching this carefully. And I think that the fact that we have sustained this for 20 years speaks to our ability to try to find other solutions to make sure that we can maintain our commitment to this program. It is what has helped Minnesota consistently achieve, if not the highest health ranking in the country, in the top 2-3 consistently over 20 years. And so erosion of this is something that we'll be watching very carefully, interested in seeing the more details as we move forward. Any other questions of members? Okay. Commissioner Johnson?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations for the Department of Human Services. The last budget page for today's discussion is on page 145 of your book. This is the result of the negotiations for the contract for self-directed workforce. The committee will recall that in 2013, the legislature passed a bill that opened the possibility of unionization for the personal care attendant program and the self-directed workers within that program in particular. Through the course of 2013 into 2014, Service Employees International Union, SEIU, began to work at organizing and were certified as the body to represent the self-directed personal care attendants. And then through the course of this fall and culminating in January, the state negotiated a contract with SEIU for the self-directed workers. Mr. Chair, to just step back a little bit, the personal care attendants are kind of, for the purposes of our discussion here, in two different groups. One group is what we sometimes call traditional PCA or agency PCA, which is about 60% of the PCAs. The other group that's around 40% or 27,000 are the ones that we're talking about here for whom the unionization was accomplished. These are in the self-directed program, so PCA Choice, consumer-directed support services, alternative care, and community support grants. And those are the individuals for whom the SEIU is representing currently. This page represents the economic pieces of the contract agreement. I need to make clear to the committee that this agreement has not been ratified by the membership yet. It's going out for vote, and so that will happen, I understand, by the end of February. And in addition, of course, there is legislative approval of the contract that goes through the process similar to other state employee contracts for approval that needs to be accomplished. There are three pieces here from a fiscal perspective. The first is a $250,000 a year appropriation to the agency in fiscal 17 and going forward that is for training. And the training would be the training sort of regimen and curriculum and partnership and how we put that together. We worked out between the department and the SEIU and the membership in their group for what kind of training would be provided. The other two pieces are pieces that are in the medical assistance forecast and affect the medical assistance forecast. The first is a wage floor, which in 2016 is $10.75 an hour, and in fiscal 17 goes up to $11 an hour. And the second is establishing paid time off, which is something that does not exist now for the self-directed workforce. And this would allow up to 5 days a year of paid time off for someone who works full-time during the course of a year as a PCA, as a self-directed PCA. And there's an accrual process and a carryover and so forth that goes with that. The way that we're actually implementing this from a fiscal perspective is through a rate increase to the PCA program, which is 1.53% in the first year and 1.73% in the second year. So what that does essentially is provides the money that we estimate is needed to establish this wage floor and establish the paid time off for this group of the workers. Two important things here. One is that the rate increase applies to the entirety of the PCA program, not just that self-directed workforce. Under federal law, we can't single them out for rate increase. We have to do it across the whole PCA program. So the traditional or agency PCA programs will get this increase too. The distinction is that the rules that I've talked about here, the wage floor and the paid time off, will only apply to the self-directed workforce. So that rate increase will pay for those pieces on the self-directed side. On the agency or traditional side, it'll be like a regular rate increase to the PCA program. 72.5% has to go to wages. Some of the existing laws that govern how rate increases are paid for the PCA program. Mr. Chair, that concludes my description of that one.
Any questions of members? Okay, I think that concludes the DHS presentations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, then we will continue with the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present.
Thank you for spending the 3 days with us. Commissioner Ellinger, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Members, we do have an MDH spreadsheet in our packets this morning, as well as a paper copy of the presentation we're going to be stepping through. So they're outside of the notebooks, but then also in the notebooks we will have a similar format with the change pages ahead as the first part in the tab that says health. So we'll probably get a high level overview and then start stepping through the change pages. That's just housekeeping to orient members. With that, Commissioner Ellinger, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to go through our budget. I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health. At the table with me is Dave Greenman, our budget director, and in addition, we have a variety of staff from various parts of the agency who are here. So together, I'm sure, with all of the expertise that we brought along with us, we'll be able to answer all or at least most of your questions and be able to get you the information if questions come up that I can't answer. My role is to, first of all, give you a little bit of overview of public health and why we are here and really what the purpose of the health department is and in the budget requests that we have. And my job as health commissioner is really try to make the case of why we should invest in public health. And I'm a physician, but I worked in the field of public health because I learned very early on in my career that just treating patients would not be enough to make our communities healthy, and we need a broader approach. So in my work in rural communities and my work in urban communities, I realized that we need to do both medical care and public health, and we need to have those integrated in ways that we haven't done really successfully in many ways. And so the investments that we make in public health, which you'll see later on, we have underinvested nationally and I believe in this state, are the reason I'm here to really make the case that why we should invest in public health. And one of the reasons we should invest in public health is that it actually makes us live longer. This slide shows that during the 20th century, we gained about 30 years of life expectancy. And that 25 of those years were really because of public health interventions. Things like immunization, food safety, motor vehicles, sanitation, control of infectious disease. And if you look at this slide, you can see the first half of the 20th century was really quite jagged in terms of its progress. That's because most of the causes of mortality in the first half of the 20th century were acute diseases, infectious diseases, sanitation issues. And you'll note particularly in 1918 where we had a big drop in life expectancy. That was because of influenza. In the last half of the 20th century, you see it's flattened out because the causes of death really became more chronic disease focused. But that doesn't mean that the infectious diseases have gone away, that we need to continue to invest in our approach to acute diseases, environmental health issues, sanitation, infectious diseases, because just in the last few months, we've seen Ebola, We now have measles, norovirus, influenza, things that we really need to continually work on. And if we really lower our guard on those, we will really be inundated with more infectious diseases. But that also says while we continue to invest in those public health approaches to acute and infectious diseases, we need to continue to now focus on chronic diseases, because those are the things that are really killing most of the citizens of our state at this point in time. So it's a two-pronged approach with both the acute diseases and the chronic diseases. And so we continue to have those improvements, and public health really is laying the groundwork for all of those. And as I talked about the fact that medical care by itself really is not sufficient to improve our health, this slide really, from some work that has been done by a variety of researchers, shows that really what determines health is mostly socioeconomic factors. About 40% of our health is determined by socioeconomic factors, 30% by behaviors, and only about 10% by medical care. So we really need to say that if we're going to be a healthy community, we have to broaden our investments, particularly to the things that public health can intervene on, the living conditions that people have and the behaviors that people choose to make. Yes, we need to invest in medical care, because we want to have the best medical care system in the country, but we want fewer and fewer people to really have to use it, because that's where a lot of the costs are. But what we as a society have done is that we invest most of our health resources into the medical care side, about 95%, and really only about 5% or less really goes into the prevention aspects of health. And that's why I think that's why I continually make the case that we have to balance our investment. We really have to make sure that we invest in all of the conditions that really improve health. And the role of public health actually goes not just beyond some of those prevention things, but actually has a role to play in the medical care system, in addition to the broader public health system that we focus on. This slide shows that on the right you have the disease intervention. That's where our healthcare system really developed around in the late 19th century, with hospitals and clinics around acute diseases and people who had conditions that were making them sick. And that's where we built most of our healthcare system. But as we learn more about risk factors, we started to move to the left. And the farther to the left we go from people affected but with some kind of condition but not yet showing symptoms, that's sort of the early identification, public health became more engaged in that. And then as we look at risk factors with vulnerable populations, there's a bigger role for public health. And finally, on the far left, really trying to make people safe and healthy in their communities, that's where public health really needs to go and where we need to make our biggest investment. So we need, on the far right, we need to play a role in identifying the quality and the systems and the resources that are available. That's sort of our quality assurance aspect of public health. And on the far left, we really have to look at all of the social conditions that really impact health. And that's where we are going with a lot of our efforts. The base budget of the in this slide shows the base budget of the Minnesota Department of Health. And when you look at this, really, you can see that the majority of our funding really comes from federal sources. Really, only about 14% of our overall budget is general fund dollars. And if you look at and some of those other things like Merck, and medical education research and special revenues, a great component of that are also federal sources. So overall, about 60% of the MDH budget is federal dollars. And many of those dollars are, and most of those dollars are actually competitive dollars, things that we have to compete for specific kinds of activities. Very few of our dollars are block grant dollars that come to us with you know, flexibility to do a variety of things. It's really more focused on specific issues. So that means that we are really dependent on federal dollars. And as we see pressures on the federal dollars, it becomes increasingly important for us to really try to broaden what kind of resources we have to address the many needs in public health in our state. And particularly some of the programs that have had lots of visibility, Office of Emergency Preparedness, 98% of that, the budget of that program is from federal sources. So that when we had the Ebola issue that we weren't able to, you know, with the Emergency Preparedness Office focusing on the things that are required through the grant does not give us a lot of flexibility to go on to do other things. So that's why we're coming with a deficiency request to be able to respond to things like Ebola. The Infectious Disease Epidemiology Program, 85% federally funded. Community and Family Health and Health Promotion and Chronic Disease, large numbers, great percentage of their programs are federally funded, and these are things that are core to the activities of what we do here in Minnesota to create health and keep people healthy. And this slide shows the general fund dollars and how we spend those general fund dollars. 67% of those go out to grants, particularly our grants to local public health, and that's where the majority of our federal or our state dollars go. Which brings us to our partners. I see in particular the fact that we need a public health enterprise. We need the federal government to be part of that equation. We need the state government to really play a significant role. But we also need our state and local. We need our local partners because that's where a lot of the public health activities occur. And this is a slide that shows the community health agencies throughout the state, the 52 community health boards that we work with on a daily basis, and also with the tribes that we work with throughout the state. The 1976 Community Health Service Act established a framework that we organized local public health into those 52 now city and county health departments, and approximately $21 million annually gets distributed under the local public health grant to the community health boards and to tribal governments. This is where we really need the partnership, and you'll see coming up that one of our, on this overall proposed budget changes that we have of really expanding our funding to local public health and some of the other programs through family home visiting and family planning special projects that really are in partnerships with our communities throughout the state that we really work on a daily basis. And so I'll be going through several of these initiatives that we have and then turn over to Dave Greenman for some of the other ones. But I wonder if you have any questions sort of on that general overview before we get into some of the specific programs.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. You know, I know we've heard a lot over the past years, and you were making mention of it about the increasing competitiveness and the decreasing number of federal dollars. Where do we stand right now in terms of the historic federal support? Is that still dropping off? Is that, what does it look like into the future? Are we picking up items in here that we're trying to make up for losses in federal dollars? That's, or should we do that in the detail as we work through?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, generally we are not seeing large increases from federal dollars, and in fact many of the programs have had cutbacks over the last several years. So we are trying to find ways to deal with that. And I think Mr. Greenman probably has more specifics of various parts of the program. Certainly in emergency preparedness, we've seen a decrease in that. We've seen a decrease in our funding for family home visiting. We've seen decreases in most of the areas that we have. And I don't know, Dave, if you have additional things to add to that.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman for the Budget Director of the Health Department. I don't really have anything to add other than to say that in a lot of cases where there's a lot of uncertainty around the federal funds as much as there's cuts. In a lot of cases we're concerned about the cuts, but we haven't really seen exactly what they're going to be yet. In general, I'd say our federal funds have remained either roughly equivalent to what we've gotten in the past, possibly going down slightly. That's a reduction from what we've already been seeing through from the past few years.
Okay. Senator Carlson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Anlinger, I'm looking at that page that you have up on the screen, and I see the $2.9 million in Ebola response, which is obviously more than 10% of the total spending. And I'm wondering, now that, as far as I know, that was not a budgeted item when the budget was first put together for your department. Where did that take the money from, and what kinds of things did we not do because we spent that amount of money on Ebola? Plus, was there federal a federal match or federal contribution to the Ebola response.
So that 2.9 is the deficiency request that is being forwarded to us. And this is similar to DHS's deficiency request. We're not going to have that bill before us. It's scheduled for a hearing in full finance on Monday. And I'll just briefly, the $2 million of the 2.9 is for the partners, the hospitals and the EMT folks that geared up and helped us, and then 0.9 is the piece that was spent by MDH, and so maybe the context as to how that went, but it is a change item that will be in here, and we will discuss it on the page as well, but maybe an initial comment or two?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, on page 18 and page 20 of your budget pages, we do have description of the our deficiency request related to Ebola, and also the for our $891,000 that we're requesting as a department, and the $2 million that the governor is requesting for helping the four hospitals that have stepped up to help us in responding to Ebola, and for the emergency medical services that also were engaged in this. In terms of your question of where did those dollars from, yes, though we were not budgeted for that, so we have had to shift resources, particularly from the infectious disease area and from some of the emergency preparedness activities, in order to mount the response that really was needed to address the Ebola issue. Because though the dollars that we shifted from some of those other grants, we are now asking for that deficiency request because we are under obligation to the federal government to respond and do the things that were required in that those grants for infectious disease. And so that's why the deficiency request is so important for us. The $2 million for the hospitals and for the emergency medical services are because for the investments that they made in retrofitting some of their facilities, training their staff, getting supplies, all of the training that was needed for the hospital response and the emergency medical services response. And so that was part of what some of their costs were.
Okay.
Thank you.
So let me continue on page 12 of your budget book, talking about how important it was for us to partner with local public health. And so one of our highest priorities is really strengthening that relationship. And so we have a request for $2 million to really enhance our grant. For local public health. This is a proposal to increase the grant to local public health by 10% for health boards in Greater Minnesota, and a similar grant of 10% for the Minnesota tribal governments. Increased funding will help strengthen their ability and tribal governments to address really some of the critical and emerging issues of the 21st century. We need a coordinated effort, as I said, between federal, state, and local, and tribal, and this is really one way to help support that. While the legislature has really vested significant public health responsibility with community health boards, the local public health grant, the primary state cost share for local health responsibilities, has really not kept pace with the rising costs and community needs over the last 20 years. The grant supported less than 7% of local public health expenditures in 2013. It was compared to 22% of local public health expenditures in 1979. We believe that the health that we have today is because of the investments we made in public health in the past, and we really need to continue and upgrade those investments in public health at the local level. Historically, communities in Greater Minnesota have received less in way of state funding to support all of their activities, and a lot of unexpected incidents that occur, especially responding to things like tuberculosis, are really expensive for local health departments, and they already stretch those tight budgets. And that's one of the primary reasons that we're focusing on rural communities and tribal governments that, with the declining resources that they have, to be able to meet those. So these funds will be used to respond to community health priorities and increase readiness to respond to public health emergencies at the local level. The next area relates to evidence-based home visiting, which is on page 14. And as you know, the governor has really focused on early childhood and children and families. And with this proposal, this is part of his overall package to enhance evidence-based family home visiting service to an additional 200 to 300 families or pregnant and parenting teens and at-risk women in Minnesota. We know that adverse childhood experiences, the things that affect kids early on in life, like poverty, child abuse, neglect, substance abuse, mental illness, can really negatively affect brain growth and limit the opportunities that children have down the road. That's why home visiting programs are really designed to intervene at that earliest time period in a family and really assist them with their needed health, education, and social services that would really help them to succeed. And evidence-based home visiting has really been one of those public health interventions that has been really demonstrated to improve, to prevent child abuse, to encourage positive parenting, that really helps promote child development and school readiness, and improves economic stability. The studies that have been shown that for every public health dollar invested in home visiting, there's a return of about $5.70 that we can expect from programs including Medicaid and TANF and food support. This proposal is really important because the current home visiting only allows Minnesota to reach a small proportion of families. And these funds will be awarded on a competitive basis to any community health board that has an evidence-based home visiting program, so we can target it at the communities that are ready to do those services and that have the greatest needs.
Commissioner, I'm a big fan of evidence-based home visiting. I do think that it does return significant savings and better outcomes for people. But is there, by funding basically a direct service in this manner through competitive grants, are we foregoing? I mean, I believe this can be covered as a Medicaid service, and we can draw down FFP on providing that service. Are we foregoing FFP by funding a service in this manner? Is there something that we maybe could look at to try to make these Medicaid billable services and provide them in that manner and have the feds share a larger percentage of these costs?
And Mr. Chair, certainly we have been working with DHS on a variety of things to try to leverage as much Medicaid dollars as possible. And as relates to family home visiting, I'll ask Mr. Greenman to see if he can give you more specifics about how we do that with this age area.
Mr. Chair, we'll Dave Greenman with the Health Department, we'll certainly work to shed more light on for you on why that Medicaid is not necessarily always the best source of funding for this. But one of the issues is that evidence-based home visiting tends to be fairly expensive, and because it's quite an investment, and Medicaid doesn't tend to reimburse at a level that's really sufficient to cover those costs.
I did the math quick. If it's $1 million a year, you know, 200 to 300 people per year, I'm guessing it's about $5,000 per recipient is what I came up with. So okay, just the things we got to get behind.
Yes. As Mr. Chair, but as
Senator Benson, did you have a question as well?
Actually, for Dr. Ellinger, what is your targeted population, and do you prioritize within that targeted population?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, these funds are going to be awarded to community health boards and tribal nations that are able to provide evidence-based programs. And we will be looking at the community needs assessment and the highest risk areas on a competitive basis, so that we target these at communities who are able to provide the service, but also are serving the highest risk populations.
Mr. Chair, if we could define highest risk, because I'm looking for the people who are actually getting the help, not the agency that's managing it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. We are looking at things like mental health issues in the community, child abuse and neglect, poverty. These are the things that really the family home visiting can help address at an early stage.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, Benson. I guess I'm trying to figure out, are these single moms, not high school graduates? Do we have a population that we're really trying to impact so as they go into motherhood, they get what they need? We're talking, Dr. Ellinger keeps referring to community mental health and things like that. I need a better idea of who's sitting across the table from the visiting home nurse.
I see it's a competitive grant process, so we'd want to see what the criteria are and what we're looking for in that process is something that we do get pretty interested in. If you have additional insights into exactly how you're scoping this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the classic visit with a home with a nurse doing a home visit is with a teen mom, a single parent, a parent who has a child with a disability, a child who is having behavior problems, a low-income family, a low-income mother. These are the individuals who we target and who really get the majority of the services through the family home visiting programs. That happens throughout the state in communities. So when we target, that's sort of a given as part of where, with their limited resources, where we target to the individuals and the families who could most benefit from that. And those are the families that really are experiencing those adverse childhood experiences, the poverty, the mental illness in their family, single parent, drug use, teen pregnancy. So those are that's the classic example of where nurses will be going to provide services.
And thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair. We're looking at $5.70 in savings, and I'd just like to know if we're going to track that, if we're going to compare the populations that are getting the visiting home services to that population who doesn't get the visiting home service, so that we can get a foundation for continuing to make these investments, savings recapture, things of that nature.
And I had an additional question on that $5.70. I wrote down over what period of time. Is that over the life of the infant and the mother served through this, or is it a shorter time period?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the studies that have been done with family home visiting, they're national studies where you have a large enough population to really make a good estimate, and those are during the life of the individual that we know that we have savings, particularly in the public expenditures. So most of those expenditures will be evaluated in the first 5 years of life in terms of the impact that they have.
Okay. All right. Any other questions of members? Okay. You can move on.
And on page 16, the family planning special projects. This also follows in the governor's idea of focusing on families, on early childhood, because we know that comprehensive family planning services are really crucial into having a child come into this life as healthy as possible. That is, again, one of those things that has been demonstrated to be very cost-effective as an important and crucial role to play in improving the health of families and children. This proposal promotes the increases in the number of pregnancies that are healthy by supporting continued statewide access to culturally appropriate family planning, counseling, and education, preconception care, screening for sexually transmitted infections, and the related laboratory testing. This proposal is important because it addresses critical disparities in infant mortality rates and rates of sexually transmitted infections, particularly among communities of color, particularly African Americans and American Indians. Again, one of the issues that we're really focusing on is advancing health equity. This proposal will serve a significant unmet need by increasing the family planning special projects grants, where clients receive services from grantees that are disproportionately from communities of color. In the last grant cycle, for example, the grant applications exceeded available funding by nearly $5 million. This funding, though, will be distributed on a population-based formula to 8 regions throughout the state to assure universal access. Family planning special projects, the programs, the comprehensive family planning service have been really identified as a high priority and effective intervention, and this helps to fund that to a higher level than currently is available.
And I'm betting you can anticipate my question. It's the same one as last time. This is a direct service to a largely Medicaid-eligible population. Are we missing an opportunity to collect FFP, often enhanced FFP for some of the family planning services, up to 90% federal on some of the family planning services? Are we missing an opportunity to make sure that we maximize the federal funding opportunities on providing this type of service?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly, Medicaid in particular, is a great source of funding for family planning services, but there are many people in the state who cannot take advantage of that service. The Family Planning Special Projects fills in some of the gaps, tries to link with Medicaid as much as possible to get individuals into service, and then where they really do try to get additional funding from Medicaid. So it is a complementary approach to providing services that are not covered by Medicaid, with the whole idea of trying to maximize and leverage resources as best we can.
Okay.
And on page 18 and 20, this is where the Ebola deficiency request is. And as I mentioned, this is part of our deficiency request, and I'm not sure if you want to go through it in this at this time, but we are really asking for $891,000 to cover our costs that we had to in place, that we had no other source of funding for. We have gotten a small amount of federal dollars, which, you know, $120,000 that we have shared with our local partners. We are continuing to look for federal dollars, but none of those dollars are going to be retroactive. They're only dollars moving forward. So we really need the $891,000 to really backfill what we've shifted to address Ebola, so we can meet our obligations with our federal partners. And similarly, on page 20, the Ebola grants for hospitals, the governor's asked for $2 million to help soften the blow that the four hospitals that stepped up, Unity, St. Paul Children's Hospital, University Fairview, and St. Mary's in Rochester, stepped up as part of their community effort to respond to this crisis by really altering markedly their services, a lot of investment in infrastructure at these facilities to be able to safely meet the needs, and also for the emergency medical services.
Questions of members? We again, a reminder, we do have the deficiency request in its entirety scheduled for a hearing in full finance on Monday, but this is our opportunity to hear from MDH on details of their deficiency request that will not otherwise come before this committee again. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I will now turn it over to Dave Greenman to go through some of the other proposals that we have in our budget for the next biennium.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is on page 22. In this proposal, the governor is recommending $900,000 from the general fund and $283,000 from the Health Care Access Fund during the fiscal year 2016-17 biennium to support increases in department compensation costs. This represents an annual increase in compensation of about 1.8%. Compensation costs have increased each year during the last several years based on labor contracts, changes in the cost of fringe benefits, and other payroll contributions. On average, over the last 10 years, for state agencies, annual compensation spending per FTE has increased by about 1.8% per year. This request is actually important to us because absorbing these rising compensation costs each year within our base budget has results in reduced staffing or reduced non-staffing resources, which diminishes the amount and quality of services we're able to provide to the public. The governor's recommendation is intended to allow us to continue to maintain our current level of operations and services to the public. For the Department of Health, this level of increase amounts to is equivalent to the cost of about 4.2 positions in fiscal year 16 and about 8.4 positions in fiscal year 17.
So are those new positions? I was just looking at that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, no, they're not. These are existing positions. Every year our compensation costs increase, but our base budget tends to not increase. And so that continues to put increased pressure on our budget, our base budget, to maintain those FTEs. And okay. So basically this increase would allow us to the value of this. Without this increase, we have pressure in the amount of about 4.2 FTE, the value of about 4.2 FTEs in fiscal year 16. We would have to figure out how to absorb those costs within our base budget.
So maybe what I'm tripping up on here is that's not how the FTE line was used through the Department of Human Services. It was new FTEs that were reflected on this line on the budget pages in DHS.
Okay.
And so members, I might not be the only one struggling over that. I had read that as new FTEs. So maybe how do you use that? Is that the consistent use of the FTEs as this would? How would we decipher between FTEs protected and FTEs that may be added in various proposals as we work through your budget book?
Mr. Chair, I guess the best way to describe this is basically our base budget. So this is essentially what we come into every biennium and ask you for to continue to fund us at our current levels. What we're asking for now is, as compensation costs have increased, and I apologize, I'm not sure what DHS's presentation looked like and how they presented their information. What we're suggesting is that as our compensation costs increase but our base budget remains flat, we have to, in order to maintain the current level of FTEs, we need to find a way to absorb those increased compensation costs, and that means either reducing our number of FTEs or finding some other non-payroll way through non-payroll cuts to absorb those additional compensation costs.
Okay, I'm corrected by staff. I guess on the operating adjustment for DHS, they treated that one the same way. But for instance, in the security hospital one that I was thinking about, it had, you know, 60 FTEs that are already hired, and they wanted, you know, the appropriation to continue that, and it had zero FTEs on sheet. So we'll have to get behind this. You guys were consistent on this reflection, but maybe not across every budget page. That's how I had read it. Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, as long as we're talking about FTEs, maybe we could have DHS and MDH tell us what their total new FTEs are at some point during the presentation.
That would actually be helpful. I don't know if anybody from DHS...
They're going to get another chance to come before us, so I think at some point.
We always take a good look at new FTEs and make sure that we have a thorough vetting of what they'd be used for. Okay, so continue on.
Mr. Chair, as I go through these, I'll mention in which proposals we're asking for additional FTEs. In none of the proposals we've discussed so far, have we requested any additional FTEs. The next proposal is on page 23. The governor's recommending an investment in strengthening protections for vulnerable adults in settings where supplemental nursing service agencies are used. Supplemental nursing service agencies provide temporary staff to nursing homes, hospitals, home care providers, and other healthcare settings that serve vulnerable adults. The use of temporary staffing agencies has increased significantly over the last 5 years due, I believe, largely to staffing shortages. Right now, the department registers about 73 supplemental nursing agencies in the state. However, the requirements and the resources to enforce those requirements are minimal, and they're insufficient to actually protect vulnerable adults. As one example, recently MDH had to initiate a revocation action against a nurse staffing agency that sent an employee with an assault conviction to a nursing home where that person allegedly committed sexual abuse on a vulnerable adult. The agency failed to provide a background check on that person. Although this kind of situation is rare, it does illustrate the importance of enforcing standards on these agencies. What this proposal does is provide resources to enable MDH to inspect these facilities once per year, which is what we do with nursing homes. It covers legal fees and staffing costs in order to enforce compliance and investigate complaints. And it requires supplemental nursing agencies to disclose their staffing records to us whenever we need them, instead of only during certain situations. The reason this proposal is important is to protect vulnerable adults in healthcare settings by treating these temporary staff the same way we would treat permanent nursing home staff. The proposal increases fees and spending by about $147,000 a year and does add one FTE to our program. The last time the fees were increased was in 2002.
It increases fees and spending such that it balances to no net state
cost. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. The next proposal is on page 25. The governor recommends an increase in, recommends a series of measures to improve oversight of the mortuary science industry. Our mortuary science program currently regulates about 600 facilities and over 1,200 professionals working in the mortuary science field. Current funding is not sufficient to oversee this large and rapidly changing industry. There's a significant amount of backlog in inspections. For example, only 19 of 59 crematories and fewer than half of all nursing homes have been inspected in the last 2 years as directed by law. There's also an increase in the number of consumer complaints. The department receives about one complaint a week for issues like misidentification and viewing of the wrong deceased person, pre-need funeral trusts not being available when they're needed, cremating without proper authorization, and other unprofessional activities. This proposal is important because with only 1.35 FTEs for this program, we're unable to investigate complaints in a timely manner. In some cases, it takes about 6 months to investigate a complaint, which is really too long for families in need. What this proposal would allow us to do is inspect nursing homes once every 2 years, enhance training and education requirements for mortuary science professionals, protect consumers from deceptive financial and pricing practices, and update state safety requirements. Fees on the industry would be increased to cover an appropriation of $187,000 per year starting in fiscal year 16. Proposal will increase staffing for the program by 1.65 FTEs. Fees for this program were last increased in 2007. Okay. The next proposal is on page 28. The governor recommends implementing a new dementia care training requirement for housing with services professionals. This law requiring the training requirement was passed in 2014. That law requires employees of housing with services providers that advertise services for persons with Alzheimer's to receive training on working with persons with dementia. The law goes into effect January 1 of 2016. But before the requirements go into effect, the new law directed the department to work with stakeholders to produce a legislative report about how we would implement and enforce the new training standards. This legislation, or this proposal, represents the work of that report. The new requirement for training that was passed in 2014 applies to direct care providers, housing supervisors, and non-direct care staff, such as maintenance staff and food support services workers. Under the proposal, rather than immediately enforcing these new training standards, the department would provide technical assistance to help providers and staff transition to the new training requirement and conduct compliance reviews to ensure that the requirements being met. The reason why we're bringing forward this proposal is to implement and enforce the requirements that you folks passed last year, and to ensure that workers know how to treat this vulnerable, extremely vulnerable population. We're paying for this this proposal through an $11,000 increase in the appropriation, and that is covered from existing fees with Housing with Services program staff or Housing with Services fees.
All right.
The next proposal is on page 30. The governor recommends updating the Health Information Oversight Program to address changes and growth in the market to better align with federal standards and provide clarity for health information exchange providers and healthcare providers who use their services. Under Minnesota law, all healthcare providers are required to have an electronic health record system in place that is able to securely exchange health data with other health information records systems. In fact, in some cases, providers have gone beyond simply having that system in place. Right now, about 40% of clinics and hospitals in the state are already exchanging data with unaffiliated providers, which is beyond what's currently required, and we expect that percentage to continue to grow. Our health information exchange law was passed in 2010 to ensure that we have a reliable health information exchange infrastructure in place to support secure transfer of data on health data, protect patient privacy, ensure adherence to state and federal laws, and to create transparency in the market. The law requires the health department to certify health information exchange providers, and these include entities that govern and facilitate the secure exchange of health information and provide infrastructure to connect computer systems for the secure transmission of health information. Minnesota's law governing health information exchange was enacted when the market was in its infancy and must now be updated to reflect changes in the industry and growth and demand. Over time, a wide variety of methods for exchanging health information have been developed, which were not contemplated when the law was initially passed. Currently, not all of these methods of exchange are covered by Minnesota's law, so exchange is currently happening that may or may not meet federal and state requirements. And our law does not clarify which methods need to be certified by the department. So what we're proposing is a number of modifications that will make it more clear about what methods need to be covered by Minnesota's law and to simplify the certification process. This proposal is important because it will ensure that whenever exchange of health information happens between providers, it follows national and state standards. It will also allow providers to use national standards to meet our state certification requirements and streamline the application process and simplify and, in some cases, reduce the fee structure to minimize any barriers to certification. We expect the number of providers that seek certification to be health information exchange providers to triple in the coming years. Even with fees being lowered for some types of organizations, we expect this proposal to result in an increase in revenue of about $100,000 per year as more providers come under our certification requirements, and we will use that additional funding to support operation of the program.
So on this one, the target, we're currently at, like, hospitals engaging with health information with unaffiliated partners. We're currently at 40, and by 2016, we're going to make it to 75%. That's an incredibly rapid increase. How are you estimating that? And does this facilitate it, or is that just a trend that's on its way and we need to have our regulatory structure make sure that it encompasses that rapid adoption?
Mr. Chair, I'm not probably dangerous for me to try to answer that question. Okay. I can either ask somebody to come up now, or we can get you a response in writing.
There's someone sitting forward. We could.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
One moment. Yes, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at MDH.
Okay.
So to your question, it really is both of those things that are happening, and we anticipate that these changes in the law will facilitate exchange happening in a way that meets state and national standards. Right now, there are 40%+ of providers that are exchanging with unaffiliated entities, and an example of that would be, for example, a hospital exchanging data with a nursing home in their community or with a clinic that is outside of their network. So an Allina hospital exchanging data related to a patient that they share with a non-Allina clinic or a non-Allina nursing home. Right now, some of that exchange is happening in ways that are not captured by our certification system. For example, if an EHR is able to speak to another EHR outside of its system, but those entities are not currently certified. So we think both because of changes in the way healthcare is delivered and the frequency with which healthcare information will need to be exchanged, that percentage is going to grow, but then the changes to the certification law will better capture the ways in which it's happening. So we'll see a greater percentage that way as well.
Okay, that's helpful.
Thank you.
Any other questions on health information exchange? We'll look forward to seeing the... You know, this. I worked hard with MDH on passing this initially, and an update is probably pretty good, pretty wise at this point. Mr. Greenman, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is our lead and radon abatement proposal, I believe. The governor is proposing to protect Minnesotans from the harmful effects of lead and radon by establishing Minnesota-based programs to oversee lead and radon abatement activities. I'll start with the lead portion of it. Lead-based paints were banned in 1978. However, there's still about 550,000 homes in the state that have lead-based paints in them, and renovating or repairing those homes can expose families and children to toxic levels of lead, which can lead potentially to learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and at very high levels could even lead to seizures or death. Currently, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency regulates renovation contractors who remove lead from our homes. However, due to limited resources, the EPA cannot provide sufficient oversight and enforcement to ensure contractors are protecting the public from lead exposure. Recently, the EPA recommended that oversight be moved to the state level in order to improve effectiveness. Minnesota-based program would provide for more local control over this industry and the use of more Minnesota-specific strategies to reduce lead exposure. What this proposal is doing is proposing to make minor changes to the state statute and rules to for Minnesota to take over, the Department of Health to take over regulation of lead contractors in the state. This new program would be supported by a certification fee of $100 paid every 2 years by firms doing lead abatement work, which is lower than the current federal fee structure of $300 every 5 years. MDH would also establish a training permit fee for lead training providers to ensure that they properly train lead contractors to protect the public from lead poisoning. The radon portion of this, I should also say that this proposal adds, I believe, about 1.5 FTEs to the lead screening program, to our lead program. The governor also recommends that the department regulate the radon mitigation industry to ensure that work meets best practice standards, is of high quality, and effectively reduces the risk of lung cancer by minimizing radon exposures. As most people know by, or many people know by now, radon is the number one cause of lung cancer for non-smokers. In Minnesota, 2 in 5 homes are considered to be have radon levels that pose a health risk, and nearly 80% of the counties in the state are rated as high radon zones. The place where radon exposure is most prevalent is in homes where radon is able to concentrate. We know that to prevent lung cancer from radon, it's necessary to have qualified contractors install radon reduction systems. These contractors are, if they're qualified and they're trained, can install the products without damaging the home or providing harm to the families. The Minnesota Radon Awareness Act, which was passed in 2013, has been successful in increasing the number of homes that are tested for radon and have had radon mitigation work done. In 2014, this was done on 3,000 homes in the state. We have received a number of complaints, though, about from both contractors, renovation contractors, and homeowners about some of the dangerous conditions that have arisen when work was not done correctly. This includes potential exposure to deadly carbon monoxide levels due to not allowing enough airflow when the work's being done, floods or leaks in the home due to a sump system not being reconnected properly, potential for fire due to contractors not using fire-rated materials or not doing electrical work properly, and just generally charging families thousands of dollars for contracted work that didn't reduce the level of radon in the home. What we would do is establish a yearly licensing fee for the program. I believe that the total appropriation for this would be $350,000, and we would I can get you the number of FTEs, but I'm not sure exactly what it is right now. But I can find it.
Two.
Thank you. Two FTEs, I heard.
All right.
For this program. The next proposal is on page 35. This is a unified regulation of retail food.
Senator Eakin.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Greenman. Just a question on the radon. It seems like awfully high numbers here as far as the homes that are affected by radon, 2 and 5 in 80 counties. Are we an outlier as far as other states in the country, or is that typical across the country?
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, we are an outlier. I believe it has something to do with the cold weather. I'm not sure, but it looks heads are nodding, so I'm feeling pretty good about that answer. So.
Geography and our weather.
Yeah, geography and our weather.
Okay.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, as long as Senator Eakin has opened the door here, our lead programs, I would think we'd have less and less risk of lead. So I'm not sure why every time you come before us, there's more money for lead abatement and training. And are we not getting a handle on this? It's been since the 1970s. You haven't been able to use paint. We've worked really hard at abatement. Why do we continue to see a need when a product was banned a decade ago, or 30 decades ago?
Mr.
30 Grimmel? Years ago. I can't even do math. I need more coffee.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, there's no known safe level for lead in children, and we've really been lowering the level of safety for lead. When I came into practice, it was, you know, we were saying 30 micrograms was normal. We're now down to under 5 is health. Not even that's healthy, but that's what's acceptable. We still have a lot of lead, particularly in old homes, that has not been abated, and that continues to be a problem, particularly for kids living in those homes. So this effort is to, we've made lots of progress, and this has been one of the public health successes, actually, is reducing the lead exposure to kids, which really impacts their IQ, it impacts their behaviors, impacts their a whole variety of things. But because of the burden of lead still remaining fairly high, particularly in older communities, this needs to continue to really be done in a way that's safe to protect the children, the family, and the workers.
So,
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Ellinger, are we ever going to see a decrease in your lead request? What will we look for to know that we've gotten there?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we will, as long as this continues to be a risk, until we can get all of the homes abated and lead out of the environment where kids will be exposed, there will be needs for this. I can't say when we will be able to stop dealing with lead, but we know that it won't be in the near future because of the housing stock that continues to be proposing risks for young families or kids and families.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I guess I would just add to that, we did have a request, I believe it was 2 years ago, around our lead program, and that had to do with the fact that the CDC was reducing federal funding for lead abatement. It wasn't necessarily that we needed additional resources to offset the federal cuts. And in this case, this is an existing program that currently is being operated by the EPA. We're not increasing that oversight. What we're doing is taking it over as a state, and it's actually reducing the cost to the contractors to do the work. But as long as, I think as Commissioner Ellinger said, as long as we still have 550,000 homes in the state that have lead-based paint in them, we continue to need to address it.
All right. Any further questions? Yes, all right.
Next proposal, the governor proposes to align the licensing and regulatory activities for retail food establishments between the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. These two departments have shared responsibility for licensing and inspecting retail food establishments. However, recent comparison between the programs operated by the two departments revealed a large number of differences, including different licensing and fee structures, different policies and procedures for training inspection staff and for conducting inspections, different methods of obtaining compliance, and different methods and authorities of enforcement. This proposal is the first major step towards aligning and streamlining the programs between the two agencies. What this does is it creates a new unified licensing structure shared by both departments that sets fees based on an establishment's level of risk which is measured in terms of the length and frequency of inspections, rather than by the size of the establishment, which is what had been set by in the past. Unified fee structure does not raise fees in any of the categories. However, because of changing which category different types of facilities are under, establishments are under, the new method of setting fees does generate additional revenue to the department of $513,000 a year. This proposal is important because we're going to reinvest these funds in further alignment between the two agencies, resulting in more clear and consistent requirements for the establishments, for business owners, more consistent application of retail food establishment requirements, and more effective communications between the department. The result of this work will be a reduction in food rates of foodborne illness in the state. And in 2016 and 17, as a result of some of this continued work towards aligning the two agencies, the work of the two agencies will be bringing forward legislation to further align the work. We expect that to come forward in the 2016-2017 sessions.
Senator Benson, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was interested, are these three new FTEs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, yes, they are.
And Mr. Chair, and yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Greenman. Are they inspecting, or are they just working on communicating between the two departments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, my understanding is that the work that's going to be entailed in bringing these two types of systems together, I mean, they're quite large regulatory systems. I believe what they're going to be doing is both doing some of the actual work of inspecting and then also doing a lot of the work related to bringing the two agencies together.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Senator
just
Benson.
To follow up, at some point after the realignment, are we going to see positions going away in these entities?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Greenman. Benson, that's a really good question. I believe that with all of our fee programs, we have over time, as when fees aren't increased and we continue to have growth in compensation costs, we tend to have to make decisions about what to do in order to absorb those costs. And in this case, I think we have had some unfilled, we have unfilled positions currently in our food program. Right now, what we would probably be doing is when the work of realigning is done, we would use those three positions to add to our staff to actually get our complement back up where it needs to be.
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make the point in child protection, there were 11 people being put into St. Paul. And now we're looking at three people not necessarily going out to do inspections. And I think we just need to be cautious that we're not losing our focus on having direct contact with the citizens and focusing on what the citizens actually benefit from when government takes these actions.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is on page 38. The governor recommends increasing.
Now, this one's not an HHS proposal, is that correct?
The drinking water protection, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the drinking water protection proposal? Yes, it is.
It is?
Yep.
Okay, the
yep.
next one. Okay.
Mr. Chair, the next proposals after that, I think, have to do with the clean water protection or the clean water fund. Those don't go through this committee.
Okay.
This one does.
So when we won't cover the ones that don't go through our committee, but let's cover this one.
The governor recommends increasing the state government special revenue fund appropriation by $2.4 million per year to maintain and expand drinking water protection activities. The proposal would also free up federal funds to be used to help water, public water suppliers meet their infrastructure needs. The increased appropriation is paid for through an increase in the public water connection fee, which is charged to most homes in the state, most connections in the state. The increase would be from $6.36 to $8.28 per year. The increased funding will support the department's drinking water protection program, which monitors drinking water in the state to make sure that Minnesotans have safe drinking water. What the program does is it samples and tests public water supply systems, certifies water operators, enforces the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, and provides technical assistance to operators. Over time, the drinking water protection program the cost for the drinking water protection program has increased, and additional funds are needed to maintain the current service levels that the current service levels. What this will do, in addition to that, will be to allow the department to continue to provide 24-hour emergency response services to public water suppliers if there's a drinking water emergency. It'll increase funding available from the Federal Drinking Water Revolving Fund to provide loans to public water suppliers for drinking water system infrastructure needs. And it'll assume greater responsibility from the Environmental Protection Agency to test for harmful contaminants in drinking water. This will add a net of 3 FTEs, and the public water service connection fee was last increased in 2005. It's typically increased once every 10 years, or we typically get it increased once every 10 years. And I believe that's the last proposal we have. I can quickly tell you what our totals are in terms of new FTEs, if that would be helpful.
You know, before we leave this, just out of curiosity, when I look at this graph, what happened between 2005 and 2006 with the small community public water supplies, that huge jump in violations? And then, you know, over time it seems to be following a little trend line down, but there's this...
I believe that, and I can certainly ask somebody to come up and talk about this, but I believe there are this is actually, if you look at the total number of violations compared to the total number of water systems in the state, it's actually a pretty low percentage. It's probably around 1-2% violations. So it's actually a very low number, but it's nevertheless not an unimportant number. But, yeah.
Yes. Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, were there new inspectors authorized in 2005?
That's what I was kind of getting behind. You know, I mean, we went from 10 to 25. You know, it may be a small percentage. I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair,
what precipitated that, you know, to 2.5 times the number of violations? Is it, you know, something that happened geologically, or did we get more inspectors on the street, or, you know, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question, and I think somebody's going to come up and help me answer if you'd like.
All right.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Division Director for Environmental Health with the Minnesota Department of Health. I believe the difference or change in the numbers there in about 2005, 2006 is really a result of changes at the federal level in standards. We have a fairly robust program of working with our industry and just a heightened awareness and indication of violations under those new standards. And as you can see, over time, they've gone down as we've worked with those providers.
Okay. All right. Well, then, Mr. Greenman, overview of the FTEs you offered, that would be very helpful to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'll quickly go through the number of FTEs by fund. For the general fund, our budget package does not include any general fund FTEs in it. There is one general fund FTE for a proposal that's currently, I believe, in the Environment Committee that's being brought forward by the Pollution Control Agency related to the Toxic Free Kids Act. We are requesting additional FTEs related to our state government special revenue fund programs. In fiscal year 17, that would be...
Mr. Greenman, could I interrupt? Are you working off a sheet there? Is that something that members would have available to them as well, or is it something we could share afterwards? I don't know if it's in the book somewhere.
I certainly can. It's our tracking sheet.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if it got sent over or not.
It's the tracking sheet is... One page.
It's the far right. It would be the far right column of the tracking sheet.
So that's the spreadsheet, the MDH spreadsheet that's in members' packet. So
yes.
Yeah, that's great.
That's right.
So then we can follow along a little bit better because we did want to. That's great.
So as you can see, there's about 13.25 FTEs in fiscal year 17 from the state government special revenue fund. You'll see the largest growth in FTEs is from the Clean Water Fund, which is not in front of this committee. The reason why that number of FTEs is so high is because we don't have a base for the Clean Water Fund. There is no base. Every 2 years, we have to come back and re-ask for the money that we've been currently getting. And so these are, for the most part, other than maybe 2 or 3 FTEs, this is these are ongoing FTEs. Actually, they're not actually new. They're existing FTEs that would be funded through our Clean Water Fund proposals.
Okay, so the ones in our division are the 13.25 from the fee-supported activities and the one general fund-supported FTE.
Mr. Chair, that's not that, and that the one general fund is not in your committee. It's in the Environment Committee.
Okay, so it's just the 13. Okay. Any further questions? And then they were detailed as we went through. We can dig behind and see the fee-supported ones as we go through the package. Any further questions of members? You know, one piece that, you know, is sometimes MDH, sometimes DHS, but that I know Senator Rosen asked one time during DHS's presentation, but I haven't seen anything in the governor's proposal yet to deal with our rapidly increasing suicide rates, particularly among youth. Did you guys work on that and think about it? Do you have thoughts as to strategies that we could employ to try to address that? In my mind, a public health concern as we move forward.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, suicide is a major public health issue. We have been working collaboratively with the Department of Human Services to do a better assessment of the data. We're really looking at collecting data and really turning the data around more quickly so people can do analyses of what those issues are. We have a staff person dedicated to who just came on, who is really working on what we can do as a public health agency in collaboration with DHS. They have more resources focused on mental health issues than we have, so our support is really in terms of a lot of the data and collaboration activities that can help with move this issue forward.
Okay. Yeah, collection is important, but interventions are pretty critical. I mean, we're all pretty familiar and sensitive to the
right. And we know in the Department of Human Services budget, the governor has added some additional resources for mental health services that will relate to this issue, not in our budget. Mr. Greenman just whispered in my ear that we have the preventive block grant from the federal government that is one of the more flexible parts of the federal funding that we have. And because of the, as we hear around the state, that mental health issues and suicide are a big focus, we have actually repurposed some of those dollars to really start to do an evaluation of what is the public health role. We've been working with our state CHS advisory committee, which represents county commissioners and health directors from throughout the state, to really have that conversation about what role can MDH play in addressing mental health. Because we have not played a big role in this in the past, but yet it is such a huge public health issue that we're using some of those dollars to really analyze how best we can partner with our other agencies to address the issue.
Other questions? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Ellinger. I guess I wanted to go back just a little bit to the 575. For every dollar invested, we get back about 575, you're saying, in savings return, which is a significant dividend. But one thing you said was that's mostly in public expenditures that you see the savings. Was there any attempt made to try to ascertain what the private impact might be as well, because we're also going to see some private impact, obviously, as far as potential loss potential if investments aren't made, or impact on the private healthcare industry, higher insurance premiums, for instance, if there's uncompensated care that's being delivered as a result of not investing in public health. Just wondering if there was any kind of attempt made to include the private impact that investment in public health might have. Now, I know that's hard to ascertain, but was there anything that was done in that regard?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, those dollars include all savings, not just in the public sector. But I pointed out the fact that there are savings in the public programs because of these, but there are broad savings throughout the community in the private sector and the public sector.
All right. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentations, and we stand adjourned, if I can find that. There it is. Thank you.